Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The Future of Europe. Speaking will be Alexander Smolar, Senior Research Fellow at CNRS in Paris and President of the Stefan Batory Foundation in Warsaw. Also, Anatol Levin, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. We begin with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening and welcome to this our panel discussion on the future of Europe. As you may know, Europe and its future and its relation to the United States have been a primary focus of our meetings at the Institute. Today's discussion will look closely at the issues that shape Europe of the future. And we are particularly privileged to have two outstanding guests who will speak on the subject, and I will start by very shortly introducing them to you. The first speaker will be Alexander Smolar, president of the Stefan Batory Foundation in Warsaw and senior researcher at Recherche Scientifique in Paris. I should mention also that he's a member of the board of the directors of our institute. His essays and other writings have appeared in journals throughout Europe and the United States. For almost 18 years, after 1989, he was political emigre in Italy, France, and England, active on behalf of opposition movements in his native Poland and other East European countries. After the collapse of the communist system, he became active in Polish politics. I'll mention only that he was advisor to the first democratically elected Prime Minister of Poland, Tadeusz Mazowiecki. Today he's one of the most acute commentators of European political life. Our second speaker is Anatol Levin, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation and former Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He previously covered Central Europe for the Financial Times, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and former Soviet Union and Russia for the Times of London, and India as a freelance journalist. Mr. Levin is the author of numerous books on foreign policy, including The Baltic Revolution, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and The Path to Independence, which won the George Orwell Prize for Political Writing and the Yale University Press Governors Award. So we'll start with Alexander Smolar.
Thank you very much. There is a certain paradox in the U.S. perception of Europe today. After several years of manifested lack of interest and with a cynicism often close to contempt, the U.S. authorities discovered that the European Union can't be ignored anymore. And perhaps most important, the president considered that the European Union is a major global partner by treating it as equal to NATO. A bipartisan EU caucus was formed in the United States Congress. But the Bush administration came out with its full support for the European Union at a point when, ironically, the European Union was going through a big crisis. It's a period when you can read in international press such titles as in The Economist, "Can this union be saved?" or in The Washington Post, "The End of Europe." And you can find, or rather you could have found just after a referendum, failed referendum on European Constitution in France and Holland, all over Anglo-Saxon world, but also in other countries, not only in Great Britain, other countries in Europe. You don't meet this sort of titles, although the atmosphere is still gloom. And you will find a lot of analyses of journalistic type or more intellectual, extremely pessimistic about Europe, especially about economic efficiency, about demographic problems, about now, especially after revolt in France, about immigration, about immigration problems. Those are subject of major preoccupation. But you will find also in the U.S., several books, maybe more influential in Europe than in the U.S., like Jeremy Rifkin, about European dream with the thesis that American dream failed and that now the future belongs in the 21st century to Europe. But you will find others who would share more or less this conviction, like Tony Judd, or you will have an opinion of Princeton professor Andrew Moravchik that this is not a crisis, which we've seen another way around. The crisis was an attempt to impose the Constitution after it upon the political body, which do not resemble at all nation state, and the problem was rather in this ambition than in the fact that this ambition failed. So we can see the very different perception and description of European reality. But that's obvious that Europe is in crisis, and it's perceived in Europe itself, everywhere. Actually, it was defined already, the sources of the crisis, many years ago, during a Lincoln summit of the European Union in December 2001, when the convention, which was supposed to prepare the Constitution, was organized. The thesis there was that the Union was at the crossroads and that it needs to become more democratic, more transparent, and more efficient. So the problem of transparency, we can say that this is more the problem maybe of the nation states than of the European Union itself. It's relatively well-functioning organization, interstate of organization between nation states. The problem of efficiency also is quite widely exaggerated. There is a lot of talk about bureaucracy, about Brussels. There are only 22,000 persons employed by European Union. So this is in not very big town you will find so many employed. So this is widely excessive. This is rather this talk about problem of efficiency. This is rather the result of a certain strategy of political conflict resolution you will find in Europe, where the nation states or elites of the nation states, when they have problems with their own constituency in making different decisions, they are usually, or at least quite often, they are accusing European Union of being the source of the problems, of that European Union, that Brussels is imposing something. So it creates frustration, and it's based on certain mythology, but the effect being that there are permanent accusations as far as the problem of efficiency is concerned. Then there is a problem of so-called democratic deficit, which is very largely discussed and which is for many observers, but also for European Union Commission, one of the major sources of the crisis of Europe. There is certainly crisis of Europe, but this is rather the problem of crisis of legitimacy than of democratic deficit. Whatever the sources of the diminishing popularity of European institutions, discontent with the economic performance, a general decline in trust towards European institutions, fear of globalization or xenophobia, they have, I believe, little to do with the European Union's democratic mandate. At its origin, the European integration was strongly legitimized by the past, by European past, by what was called European Civil War 1914-1945. European integration was strongly legitimized by the fear of war, of permanent instability, of pre-war wild nationalism, of totalitarian temptation, of possible comeback of German imperial ambition, at least but not last of Soviet threat. Those factors of legitimacy weakened very much with the end of the Cold War, with the memory of the Second World War withering away, with the democratic character of Federal Republic confirmed, with the implosion of Soviet Empire. Even long before that, the pragmatic sources of legitimacy associated with the efficiency of union became increasingly important: trade, economic growth, communitarian laws and regulations. Those sources of legitimacy were put into question by demographic tendencies, European Union enlargement and economic problems of Europe. Today's frustration of Europeans with the Union forces to explain not why it made sense to launch integration more than 50 years ago, but why it's still worth to continue. Good sides of Europe are considered by the last two generations as natural, nothing exciting about it. Bad sides of Europe, so-called bureaucracy inefficiency, are identified with European institutions. The new pragmatic answer to the question why together are associated with the major challenges of the modern world: globalization, ecology, and terrorism. But the European Union till now is not considered as particularly efficient in those domains. So we are facing for the first time the fact that millions of Europeans have turned their backs on the Union, whose geography, identity, and ambition seemed murky. The treaty prepared by the Convention contained a set of very useful and modest reforms, yet European leaders presented them as a grand sham for democratization of the European Union. Calling the treaty a constitution was a bad idea, although many of the proposals were good. The problem is that there is no European with the people, and there will not be one a long time from now. A constitution is something new a new independent state gives itself, or something that an old state can change from time to time. France changed 12 times, if I'm not wrong, since the French Revolution. European Union is not an independent state, and the European Commission is not a government. Calling the proposed treaty a constitution raised ambitions that will not be satisfied and fears that cannot be mastered. The major problem of European Union are, however, elsewhere. These are demographic decline, as I mentioned, economic inefficiency, especially in France, Germany, and Italy, and the question of frontiers. But what Europe really needs provokes, as wrote Farid Zakaria in one of his articles, a populist paranoia. And Europe needs economic reform to survive in an era of economic competition, more immigrants to sustain its social model, welfare state, European type of welfare state, and see more positive attitudes towards its neighbors, towards prospects of further enlargement of European unions. Well, just mention a few facts. Europe's birth rate have dropped well below the replacement rate of 2 and 1 children. Now it's the level 1 and 1.5 only. Wherever they look, Western Europeans feel their way of life threatened. One solution to low birth rate is higher immigration, but many Europeans don't like the immigration they have. Often Muslim from North Africa, and don't want more. It was only reinforced after bomb attacks in London and recent revolt in France. One way to revive economic growth would be to reduce social benefits, taxes and regulations, but that would imperil Europe's social model, which supposedly blends capitalism efficiency with a strong present of a solidaristic principle. A problem of national identity is certainly one of the important factors of European crisis. Western Europe today has almost as many foreign-born citizens as United States. But its countries don't think of themselves as immigrant nation. They are calling as immigrants quite often people who are French or German citizens and whose parents or grandparents came to those countries. Europe does not know how to integrate them. Old Jacobinian doctrine of assimilation doesn't work anymore with the mass immigration from Arab countries. German model of Gastarbeiter, invited only for a few years, doesn't work either, because those immigrants, today German citizens, they are not going back. And the only model which exists, which is called in Europe Anglo-Saxon, American, you know, and adopted more or less by British, is till today it's not adopted by other countries. And the American idea of a national identity based on ideas and values is very far from the countries where still the origin, the geography plays an enormous role in spite of rhetorics on Republican values and so on. So this is one of the, beside demographic problem of migration, certainly this is one of the most dramatic, the major problems and the much more important source of the crisis than economic, the problems with economic efficiency, which at least we know how to solve. And there is certain progress in Germany. One can hope that we will see in a few years in France and in Italy as well. So probably it will be solved, let's say, in 10 years' time. It's not that obvious with demography, declining demography, and with emigration. One of the Europeans' problems, partly certainly this is an answer to the feeling of crisis, of discontent with Europe. This is what one can call a renationalization of Europe. We can see it now during negotiation about budget for European Union for the period 2007-2013, how it's extremely difficult for the member state country to renounce from relatively limited resources for the to maintain the principle of solidarity, traditional principle of solidarity of European Union. Let's say European Union's till today was giving four type of advantages. It created a big market and common euro for most of the countries of the European Union. It helped to increase the influence of the member states in the world. Maybe not directly political, but this is visible, for example, in trade negotiation, in WTO, or in direct negotiation between Europe and United States, when individual nation state would be very weak vis-à-vis US, and Europe together is certainly a strong partner. Then European Union provides a framework for law and cooperation for its member. And fourth, which is quite important, especially now with the doctrine of President Bush, this is the achievements of European Union is the aid to civil nation building. In its own neighborhood, Europe is the leading promoter of democracy, certainly. And European soft power is certainly more efficient than U.S. military hard power in democracy and human rights promotion. This is great examples of Spain, Portugal, and Greece in the past. This is an example of East Central European countries, which the quite miraculous case of the very peaceful democratic transition to relatively already modern state. And the example of Turkey is extremely important. It's difficult to say whether the European Union finally will accept Turkey as a member state, but still already now the impact of the conditionalities imposed by European Union upon Turkey was very impressive, and the evolution of Turkey was very positive in accepting more and more the norms, human rights norms, democratic liberal norms, which are accepted in the European Union. Now, the French and Dutch referendum will halt both deepening and widening in the European Union. Nobody really knows now how to assure further progress of European internal integration, and nobody really wants to talk about further enlargement, although the formal negotiation with Turkey started in October, but it was pure formality. It was promised, but nobody really wants to talk it. So this referendum, this constitution, was refused in France to a big extent, it was not refusal of European Union, but just the opposite. In the name of better, more integrated, real political European Union, the Constitution was refused. But the effect is that probably it was the end of the dream of the political European Union, of what Giscard d'Estaing called l'Europe puissance, Europe as a powerhouse, as opposed to Europe as a space, more or less British type past dream of Europe as a just common market and common legal rules. Now, to finish, so what is possible a solution of this dramatic linkages between the deepening and enlargement? How to overcome the opposition which was named by one British scholar of liberal expansionists who would like to expansion of Europe, but to keep institutional integration of Europe on the low level, versus social integrationists who would rather refuse expansion, further expansion of Europe, in order to have political Europe. It seems that the only possible solution is to abandon the dream of Europe as a more or less imitation, written large of the nation state. There will be not any more, and very few beside France you will find enthusiasts for this vision of integrated, politically integrated, federalist Europe. But nobody would like either to dissolve Europe or to have Europe à la carte, as it's called in European language. It means that everybody is just picking up what he wants from the different dishes which can be called Europe. There must be something in between, that the only possibility of further enlargement, which is necessary also for Europe, because this is the pressure exercise upon Europe from the south and from the east, can be only solved, and stabilization only paradoxically through further enlargement. And for example, recently published report by ex-Italian Prime Minister Amato on Balkans, it's very clear. You cannot really create nation states out of ex-republics of ex-Yugoslavia outside the European Union. Paradoxically, only inside the European Union you can, out of those nations, create the communities and peacefully coexisting communities. So the only possible solution, this is European Union with a sort of a variable geometry, which would mean that there will be certain elements common, like common market, like law, accepted by everybody. But beside that, different countries can accept different elements of integration, provided that they can join the avant-garde, those who accept further and the most radical integration, that the others can join, that this is not exclusive, that this is not the way of discrimination of inside Europe and separation inside European Union. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. And I'm delighted to be speaking alongside Alex Molar, whose work I've admired for so many years. I'm afraid from that point of view, something terrible has happened. I don't know what you were expecting, but it's possible that what this was set up as was a gladiatorial contest in which Alex and I would circle around each other armed with swords and spears. I'm sorry to say that I agree with everything he said, literally everything. And so I will simply try to expand on one or two points. I regard myself as a hereditary European, and I think that especially anybody with any sense of Europe's dreadful history over the past couple of hundred years has to retain a commitment to the European idea and a deep gratitude for what the European Union has helped to achieve over the past 50 years. It is, after all, not nothing to have abolished, at least for the foreseeable future, and by that I mean 100 years or so, the idea of war between the major states of Western and Central Europe. That's quite an achievement. At the same time, as I believe Lord Keynes said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? I think it would be very difficult, in view of developments in Europe over the past couple of years, or indeed in some ways ever since Europe's failure over Bosnia in the early 1990s, to retain a faith in the idea of Europe becoming a super state, a true federation, a great power in the world in terms of something, you know, roughly equivalent to the United States. What Europe has become, I think, and Alex touched on this, is a cultural space. I mean, there is a real sense, at least among, I would say, most of the Europeans, elites by now, a sense of belonging to the same region in terms of at least certain basic aspects of culture. And that means political culture, obviously, democracy and so on, but not just that. In the field of economics, even Britain, which is, of course, much closer to the American model than any other European country. But if you know Britain and you know America, you realise that the British economy, the British economic model, if you can call it that, is still much, much closer to one or other of the continental European models than it is to the United States today. And indeed that any British government which attempted to take Britain really towards a full-scale American way of doing things would simply make itself unelectable, and that is a serious problem for the British Conservative Party today. Europe, I think, as Alex has said, will survive. Neil Asherson, in a recent issue of the London Review of Books, had a rather beautiful phrase for Europe. He called it a polity of a new type, a giant spongy being, colonised by a myriad of smaller organisms, breathing prosperity and inventiveness in and out through its pores, indistinct in outline, happily, I would say perhaps unhappily in certain cases, but he says happily incapable of rapid decisions about peace or war. And in that way, I think Europe will continue. The question is, though, what effect there will be on Europe and on your individual European countries and on the image of Europe, as far as the outside world is concerned, of future crises. Because nation states, modern nation states, particularly, of course, if they have pre-modern roots, have shown over the past 100 years or so that they are capable of surviving the most immense catastrophes. If one looks at what's happened to Germany, if one looks at what's happened to a range of other countries around the world, even colossal defeat in war has not destroyed once again the nation state. Now, with multinational organisations or bodies or even countries, that is much less certain. If one looks, for example, at the Soviet Union, which after all set itself up as a kind of multinational opposition to the West. I mean, it had an idea of itself as an alternative political economic culture that was going to bring many different nations together and turn them into the new Soviet or the new socialist man. Organizations like that have to succeed. They cannot afford catastrophic failure. And I think this is something that we've forgotten, thanks to our wonderful history over the past 60 years, which is that, you know, history is a long business and we don't know what crises are going to hit us in future. When it comes to smaller scale crises, we've weathered quite a range of them with remarkable success. I mean, even the oil shocks of the 1970s, which brought to an end the long post-war boom and which in Britain helped to usher in the rule of Margaret Thatcher, did not destroy the Western system or the or specifically the European Union. The euro, it must be said, and this is something of an argument for a more optimistic view, perhaps, of Europe's future, was ushered in with remarkably little trouble when you think about it. I mean, just imagine what would happen in this country if anyone proposed abolishing the dollar and, you know, merging it in some, you know, international currency. Well, I don't think the administration concerned would last very long. The euro has been introduced and so far has had considerable success. But if there were a really serious economic crisis in future, and if the European Central Bank told the French government in particular that it simply had to preserve the euro, impose really serious measures of austerity, and if it were quite clear to the French government from opinion polls that as a result of this, the French government would lose the next elections, and, I mean, to be fairer to a French government or a German government, for that matter, or any other government, it looked as if, as a result of this, an extreme right-wing chauvinist or populist party would come to power and would perhaps begin to, you know, destroy France's membership of the European Union. I don't think there can be any doubt that the French government would reject these measures and would, in fact, pull out of the euro if necessary. Now, we can all, of course, hope and pray that nothing of that sort will happen. But I must say I wouldn't put much money on it not happening at some stage. As I've said, history is a long business. The amount of money I would put on it not happening is not of great significance. More significant is what a Chinese official said to me not long ago, because I was asking him, of course, about China's willingness to go on, you know, putting money into dollars rather than euros. And he said that the main reason for this, of course, it's part of the general strategy of fueling the American consumer boom, which in turn fuels our economic growth and our industrial growth. But he did say that somewhere among the secondary factors why China goes on putting money into the dollar and not into the euro, for example, is that the Chinese, in the kind of hard-headed realist way, can't quite believe in the euro somehow. They can't quite believe that it, you know, that the European Union would be able to preserve it in the face of a real crisis. And they simply think that the dollar is a better bet from that point of view. The question, I mean, the second crisis, a possible crisis, at some stage which could affect the Union, has also been touched on by Alex, and that is, of course, the security threat, the mixture of the threat of terrorism with Muslim immigration. I was in Holland recently for a couple of lectures, and a Dutch left-wing friend, I won't say liberal, although that's what he was, but in Holland the liberals, as you may know, are actually now a right-wing party, so it gets a bit complicated. But he said, and the other people at the table echoed this, that if he, as you may know, I mean, Holland has suffered a considerable swing to the right in recent years as a result of a reaction against, above all, Muslim immigration, and then on top of that, the murder of this Dutch filmmaker, Theo van Gogh. He said that he thought that if on top of this there were a really serious terrorist attack in Holland, on the scale, say, of Madrid, that the Dutch extreme right would win the next elections and dominate Dutch politics for the foreseeable future. A French official I talked to in Washington said, yeah, you know, you've got to understand that there are domestic reasons for our foreign policy as well. But at least we think that our stance over Iraq has probably diminished the threat from Al-Qaeda and its allies of carrying out terrorist threats on French soil. And, you know, from the point of view of preserving French democracy and through France European democracy, you know, that is a good thing, because if on top of all these other problems with immigrants, we then had really dreadful terrorist attacks as well, once again, what it would do to the vote for the extreme right in France, you know, could be something which would have a truly frightening effect on not just the French democratic model, but on that of Europe as a whole. Now, from that point of view, of course, viewed from America, one mustn't be unfair to the Europeans about immigration. In France, there's an old tradition of civic nationalism, the ideological roots of which, by the way, are very close to American civic nationalism, the rights of man, the Constitution, progress. I've always said, you know, part of the hatred between America and France comes from the fact that you're basically two brothers quarrelling over the same pair of trousers. Of course, the French resent desperately that they used to be the elder brother, and now you've, you know, grown and grown and grown, and they're never going to get the trousers back. But on de Gaulle's statue in the Champs-Élysées, it's written from one of his speeches, "Since time immemorial, there has existed a covenant between the grandeur of France and the liberty of mankind." A completely American sentiment. And France has in the past assimilated successfully an enormous range of immigrants. The most probably the prime minister, the next president, Hungarian, many Poles, of course, a great many Italians, and has done reasonably well with its West Indians as well. The problem is, once again, the Muslim immigration. And I do have to say, from that point of view, you know, speaking to an American audience, just imagine what American politics would look like if Mexico were a Muslim country and if Central America were a Muslim region. I mean, it is almost unimaginable by now what would have happened politically within America if that were the case. I mean, as it is, there is a certain anxiety being raised by, you know, certain of the old-style Pat Buchanan-type conservatives, Samuel Huntington and so forth, about a change in the American national identity produced by Latino immigration. If these people were Muslims, America would be in a state of political hysteria by now. And Europe could be heading in a direction of political hysteria over that. I mean, given the demographic decline, given the continued high Muslim birth rates, and the terrorist threat on top of that, I am severely worried, really worried about the future from that point of view. Now, that then leads to the question of the Transatlantic Alliance, because it is now evidently an open question, not a decided question by any manner of means, but an open question as far as many Europeans are concerned. And this was brought out by the comment of this French official, which I cited, whether on balance America contributes to the security of Europe, the alliance with America contributes to the security of Europe, or detracts from it. In a couple of ways, it obviously contributes, without question. One is to suppressing or containing or freezing national conflicts in the Balkans, where it was, of course, America that finally played the critical role after Europe had failed. And it's very, very questionable whether even today the European Union would be capable of coping, you know, even with a relatively limited crisis in Kosovo, for example. The second way in which, although with a certain ambiguity, America continues to play a key role is, of course, as the ultimate guarantor against any potential future revival of a Russian security threat to Europe. The ambiguity here, of course, comes into it's the question of Europe's borders. When it comes to Poland, Central Europe, let alone Western Europe, there is no Russian security threat now and never will be. If, of course, Europe expands to take in Ukraine, and let alone the Caucasus, it begins to look like a very different matter. And, of course, then it comes to a question of whether America, by pushing what I would regard as a premature enlargement of NATO to Ukraine, premature only in the sense if it becomes decoupled from European Union membership, may not increase European insecurity from that point of view. But from another point of view, as raised by this French official, there is at least an argument that the alliance with Europe is detracting from European security by increasing the threat of terrorist attack on Europe. Now, there's a counter-argument which says that the ambitions of Al-Qaeda and its allies are so insanely megalomaniac that actually in the long run they're going to come after Europe anyway, above all because, of course, of the presence of Muslim immigrants, but also because of historical Muslim claims on certain parts of European territory. But certainly in terms of the immediate terrorist threat today, there's no doubt that the closer you are to the United States, the more endangered you are from terrorism. And as I say, the problem resulting from that is not... I mean, if it were just a question of casualties, I myself would argue we have got to bear them as part of this struggle. The problem is, of course, as I've said, the potential impact on European democracy and on the European model for the world. Because what truly concerns me is the fear that this model will not only fail on its periphery, as it's already beginning to do in Russia, for example, and well, it hasn't even taken off on other parts of the periphery, but that it will begin to rot from the centre. And a Lithuanian friend said to me when I was in Paris the last time and met her there, you do realise that if Le Pen or anyone like Le Pen ever wins in France, democracy in Lithuania won't be worth a button. You know, it's very much the Western democratic model which has led to Lithuanians, you know, moving to liberal democracy, most of the way to liberal democracy. If the whole model falls in from the centre, then it will fall in on the periphery as well. And that, of course, would be a catastrophe, a disaster for Europe as a whole, and I think for the wider world, because as I've always argued, I've always been sceptical about the idea of spreading democracy by force or by lecturing. But I've always passionately believed in our ability to spread democracy by example, you know, by showing other countries that our model works better. And we did that with fantastic success as far as the communist bloc and then the Soviet Union itself is concerned. And we've had very considerable success in other parts of the world as well. But it depends on us preserving our democratic model and example. A lot has been said about the terrible effect of scenes from Katrina on the image of America from that point of view. Well, I mean, the scenes from Paris have been pretty bad as well. And if indeed this model does crumble, then it will be a catastrophe for the world. To conclude, from an American point of view, how much does this really matter, what happens in Europe? The Bush administration, as Alex said, has been, you know, now very much reaching out to Europe again, at least rhetorically. When it comes to making serious concessions as to real policy, of course, much less has been done from Washington. Well, is it worth it from America's point of view? I mean, what in the end can Europe or will Europe do to help America? In military terms, of course, in direct military terms, Europe can do very little. I mean, let's face it, even the British contribution, which has been far, far greater than anybody else, has been very limited in terms of numbers. I mean, our casualties have been disproportionately high, proportionate to our numbers, but then our numbers have been so much smaller. I mean, what is it, like 5% of the American troops? And Poland even less, and nobody else really at all. However, from another point of view, of course, Europe is militarily important to the United States, and that's in terms of bases. NATO has been a great vehicle, a carriage, if you like, for American military power, not in terms of what it's contributed directly, except in Afghanistan, where it could now be playing a more and more important role. But in terms of allowing America to use Europe as a base and project its power from there. But there's no good dreaming. I mean, in the context of this debate, which is now growing and growing in America about Iraq, you still have people saying, oh, we must internationalise the conflict, you know, we must bring, and that means basically bringing in more Europeans. That's foolish. I mean, A, it's not going to happen. B, even if it did happen, all that means, as far as the Muslim world is concerned, is turning it from American imperialism into Western imperialism. This is something which the Muslims themselves have to sort out in the long run. Elsewhere in the Middle East, Europe could help if the US allows it to. Given that the ideas of actually attacking Iran are now busted, it's pretty clear that the British, German and French approach is the only one left. Now, that has to be backed up by US pressure, and it should be backed up by stronger European pressure over the threat of sanctions. But equally, if it's going to work, America has to offer the Iranians greater concessions, which is, of course, what even the British have been telling America to do for a long time. Europe could play a critical role in bringing a settlement to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, above all through financial means, compensation for Palestinian refugees. But once again, it can only do so if America allows it to, which means America adopting a settlement which is at least minimally acceptable to Europeans. There is no sign of America being willing to do that, or indeed of the present Israeli leadership being willing to do that either. I would say, more generally, to conclude, that Europe could be or should be very important to America if America views its own world power and its own goals in the world from a rather different angle. Not a completely different angle by any manner of means, but an angle which has less to do with American power as such, and more to do with preserving and strengthening, or at least shoring up, the international capitalist system or market system, on which in the end not only the American system but modern civilization as we understand it depends. If America returned to something more like, or at least more sincerely like, Clinton's idea of a world of networks in which the US, you know, positions itself as a central part of every network, then the European Union becomes absolutely critical to America's role in the world as the leader of the international capitalist system and as the promoter of democracy in the world. Because, as Alex said, you know, if you look at the enlargement of the market democratic model to Central and Eastern Europe over the past 15 years, and the impact that that has had on spreading the image of democracy in the world, of successful democracy more widely, Americans really do need to recognise that it has been the European Union that has done the heavy lifting. It's the European Union which has focused these countries on really reforming in detail their economies, their political systems. The European Union has also, quite frankly, I mean, even if you look at European Union aid, let alone bilateral aid from European countries, given more than 10 times the aid, more than 10 times the aid that America has given to the East European countries as part of the EU accession process over the past 10 years. And this has come, of course, at the expense of West European taxpayers. Now, from that point of view, I do think that America has to become more careful, because it has not escaped, and that too played a part in the French referendum, at least. It has not escaped the mind of taxpayers in France and indeed in Germany, that in asking for this kind of subsidy from Western Europe, while trying to hew to a really pro-American line in geopolitics, even when majorities, even in Eastern Europe actually very often, and large majorities throughout Western Europe, even in countries like Britain, Italy, Spain that supported the Iraq War, in trying to combine these two things, East European countries are asking key countries in Western Europe to do something which America would not do for a single moment, except in the case of Israel, the very special case of Israel, which is to subsidize other countries massively without asking anything from them in geopolitical terms. That was not going to last forever in any case, and I think that this business of the prisons, the alleged prisons, in Poland and Romania could bring that issue to a head very quickly. There is talk of suspending Poland's voting rights, and there's talk of suspending Romania's accession process. That would, of course, lead to a tremendous crisis, not only in transatlantic relations, but in politics within the European Union. And, of course, it's a crisis that might not by any means lead to a stronger European Union. It might lead to yet another European failure and botch. But I think that could be the first of a whole series of crises which will affect Europe and the transatlantic relationship in the years to come, and the outcome of which we cannot at present foresee. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The Future of Europe. Speaking was Alexander Smolar, Senior Research Fellow at CNRS in Paris and President of the Stefan Batory Foundation in Warsaw. Also, Anatole Levin, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. We began with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.